Alex made his AV debut at AV9 last year with a truly outstanding and insightful presentation. And then he absolutely excelled himself when he chaired the big debate on the Saturday evening. And for me, it was an absolute no-brainer to bring Alex across from Belgium, where he's heading back tonight, because I believe you've got an engagement in
Brussels tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, thank you so much for making the effort to come here today. So I'm sure regular viewers of UK Column are familiar with Alex and his outstanding analysis of contemporary events. So it's great pleasure that I welcome Alex to AV 9.1.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you. Okay. Well, Brian's set up the stall very well for me, as I knew he would. I don't have such interesting pickies as Brian has, but that's because I need to pick up on the very things that Brian was asking about and go back one level. Brian was saying, what is the religion of these people? And that's the question I'm going to try to answer for you today. And as the blurb set out, I believe that there are actually at least two major persuasions of elitists or cabals when it comes to modern Britain. And in fact, they're fighting over Britain more than they are almost anywhere else in the world, which is why we haven't been flattened in the kind of wars and pestilence that we like to spread out from these shores. But it also means that we can't go our own way and live in peace. We have to be global Britain. We have to be at the heart of Europe and in all the international organizations. So I call this an infernal convergence, a marriage made in hell. And it's two persuasions of elitists, one more strongly represented in Britain than the other, but they're both here, certainly since the end of the Second World War. And if you like the alternative title, it's the asset stripping of Airstrip 1, because of course Airstrip 1 is what George Orwell's 1984 calls Britain. It is a country that's not being run by, even by its own native elite for its own people's benefit anymore, but because it is of use to the rest of the world in bringing the agenda on. And I've even thought up an esoteric use of a Bible quotation from the Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 6, because I did one from Romans in the last talk. It's not the original context, because Song of Solomon is about the bride, right? But you could apply it to poor Britain. When the bride or Britain says, they made me the keeper of the vineyards, but mine own vineyard have I not kept. I hope you're seeing what I'm meaning by that. We're being obliged to do service. We're being pressed into service by elitists to export revolution to the world. And the price of that is we're neglecting our own people and our own way of life, and nobody will leave us alone. In a more jingoistic period, we used to sing this a lot. Rule Britannia, Britannia rule the waves, Britons never, never, never will be slaves. James Thompson, the Scot, made it good in London not long after the Act of Union, a namesake of mine. And fast forward a century and a half, and you have one of my nemesises from the AV9 talk, George Bernard Shaw. You'll remember if you were there that he was a mouthpiece for the Astor family. And what does Shaw say? Englishmen never will be slaves. They're free to do whatever the government and public opinion allow them. That sets the tone for this piece. We cannot be conquered, humanly speaking, by the usual means of being overawed, shock and awe campaigns, and being brought down. It's much better for us to be flattered and have our opinions tickled and to be told that we really want to lead the world into new change agendas. So that's what's been done to us. I talked about cabals and cartels. Just to refresh your memory a bit, a cabal is not quite the same thing as a cartel. A cartel is a bunch of businessmen, mercantilists, who get together and say, let's stitch up the market between us, elbow out the small guys and the foreign players, and have a corporatist closed shop. So that we can, the classic example of a cartel is fixing the price of a commodity like glass or copper. A cabal is a rather more political twin to the economic beast that is a cartel. A cabal, its etymology may come from Kabbalah, or it may come from a ministry just before the English Civil War, the English Revolution of 1688, where the initial letters of the main gentlemen were made up of, who had steered the state into a bunch of private individuals running the crown as a corporation. That's what we've had ever since, okay? So these gentlemen, Clifford, Arlington, Buckingham, Ashley, and Lauderdale, who persuaded us that we had had a glorious revolution and we'd brought in democracy. The theme of this talk today is democracy. How's it gone wrong? Well, The idea of democracy that was waved in front of our faces in the English revolutionary year, 1688, was already, I think, from the outset, pre-programmed to be a front for elitist control. A cabal's a group of chums, each of whom pretend to be mere ministers or entrepreneurs, but actually they combine, combination is an old word for conspiracy, to exert a monopolistic influence over public bodies. The fiction that's maintained is that the members of the cabal are of differing political persuasions. We're going to see this again in the Brexit sham. We may have a government of unity, national unity, as we did in the Depression and the Second World War. You'll have the Red Team and the Blue Team and the Scottish Nationalist Team and who knows what else, perhaps all joining. The fiction is that these guys are of different political persuasions. Brian has explained to you why it's a fiction. A cabal actually depends on bloodlines and clandestine meetings. So it's not important what hats people are wearing, what bodies they're in. It's a question of who they are, who they represent in their bloodline. But nowadays, cabals are searching for new blood. They're reaching out to the third sector, which is a creation of their own, the meritocracy, a word which was spun out between the wars to mean we want to bring on board, to co-opt promising young people. And it's also using the technique of anonymization or deniability via digital media. Extinction Rebellion, you just heard about, is a great example. It looks like a bunch of revolting plebs, doesn't it? You know, the plebs are revolting in the streets, but actually it is revolting elitists. How do cabals act? We're going to get into the two wings in a moment, but first you have to see what the beast is itself. Cabals act with common purpose. This gentleman is a retired policeman, and he will tell you that acting at common purpose is a crime at common law. In fact, it's a criminal offence at common law, not even a civil offence. But that is the name in which a political charity now boasts. Cabals as a way of life is actually accepted by some of our neighbours. I won't go over the ground of my AV9 talk again, but you will know that there's an area on the continent where the Frankish tribe dominates, from the Channel right down to northern Italy, basically. Parts of France and Germany are in it as well. There, they accept cabals and cartels as a way of life. They are happy to be ruled by their betters, right? This is why they're less trouble than we are to shoehorn into international bodies. We take more persuading. Sometimes a cabal is even seen there as a defence against what they call Anglo-Saxon deregulated financial capitalism. But this is where the two wings come in, as you'll see in a moment, because these guys are playing the same game with two different masks on. In the continental model, why do people accept being run by a bunch of regents, as they're sometimes called on the continent? Well, because that's seen as acceptable because the captains of industry in that model view themselves as part of the people. They have the knack of pretending not to be above us. They don't send their kids to boarding school. They don't. They're not resplendent in nicer clothes than the rest of the population. They are in and off the model. One of the names for this is the Rhineland model of capitalism. Okay, the Asian states, on the other hand, have always taken this as a threat, private interests running the states, and so they have always, especially the Chinese, tried to break this up. You'll see why I'm getting into geopolitics in a moment. There's a very geographical element, and Britain's at the heart of it. The British, and behind them the Dutch and the Germans, where our bloodlines come from, you can go back further to northern Italy. Right, the British elitists and the Germanics have always exported cabals as a model. That was what I was getting at in AV9. But you have a problem in common law jurisdictions. You cannot openly say in a government that's supposed to be of the people, for the people, and by the people, that you are, in fact, a bunch of private interests. And you can't say, we the corporation, you have to say, we the crown. And then you have the fiction, of course, that the crown can be a corporate crown, whereas, in fact, it's a personal embodiment by oath. The corporation soul and the corporation complex, switcheroony. So what you have to do in common law jurisdictions is you have to present it as cabinet government. Right. One of the things that's gone wrong since the Second World War in Britain is we have lost local democracy. Ian is a stalwart advocate of real local democracy. Who was it who cabbaged local democracy? It was no kind of socialist. It was the Heath Conservative government in 1974 and the Thatcher Conservative government in the mid-80s, who reorganized the councils, stripped layers away, and then Cameron completed it by making more and more unitary authorities. So what have these unitary authorities done, or these councils? They have gone to a different model of who runs the show, in which instead of the councillors being severally and jointly responsible for government, you have a cabinet within, a bunch of people meeting in a kabal again. So this model is not just national now, it goes down to the regional, local and district level and up to the global level. That's a lot of text, and I went through this on AV9, but just to refresh your memories, these are the core techniques that cabals use, and then I think we go straight in after this to the two types, the persuasions. They're not interested in petty matters of who controls what trade, as long as the model keeps working. So you have to have a model for dispute resolution. You know, if one corporation is at the throats of another, you control the dispute resolution mechanisms. This is one of the reasons why Britain is at the centre of things, because we like to tout our expertise in arbitration, arbitrage, selling our jurisdiction as the place for companies to do business. Seizure of intellectual property is another one. How many of you have followed the duo that call themselves Able Danger? Yes, David Hawkins, is the engineering brains of the duo, and he keeps talking, and you should go and look at him, including a series of interviews now which are on YouTube on the Jason Goodman channel. David Hawkins there is coming out with his stuff in better audio quality and more cogently than he was ever able to do on the shoestring operation of Able Danger. And he keeps saying, look at what the British Crown has done around the world. It's embedded itself in the up-and-coming powers in Germany, in Russia, and above all in America. And it's thieved the intellectual property of those countries. That's what Serco is, above all, right? It puts its tentacles into America and says, we'll have your intellectual property, please, your patents, your national security infrastructure, the things that keep your planes in the air, the security cameras, the visa issuance, and we can slip in as many criminals, thugs, and patsy terrorists as we want under your radar, okay? There's the idea of bogus independence of public bodies. Brian is always talking on UK Column about the independent body for this and that, which is nothing of the short. It's fake transparency. Wherever you hear the word transparent, think opaque. Asset stripping of public bodies. Okay, this is an absolutely key one. The City of London's done this to the world, and now it's happening in Britain as well. Fracking is perhaps the ultimate asset strip of the nation, which is why Ian has been so good at getting people stirred up about it, because it's taking the subsoil assets of the nation and saying these actually belong to the Crown corporate, yeah, not the Crown soul. Because if you pleaded that the Crown soul, the historical idea of the Queen on her oath, it's ridiculous to say that she owns all the subsoil. What can she do with it? But if you say it belongs to a corporation masquerading as the Crown, then suddenly it makes sense that they want to sell off these assets. And also, who would want to foul their own pigsty or by their own backyard and turn it into a pigsty? And there's a north-south divide in this, obviously. One of the factors is gents living in the home counties are saying, who cares what happens to the Boland Shale and the north of England becoming uninhabitable and a nuclear waste dump? That's one level of it. But now you've got foreign speculators whose business isn't even in fracking coming in and really not caring whether Britain is uninhabitable, because their only connection with Britain is through corporations which are hanging on the corporate Crown side of the model. That's their presence in Britain through the city. Okay, so that's the asset stripping. One of the reasons why until now we have, in a physical sense, our resources, we've been fairly unscathed while the rest of the world has seen open caste mining and natives being thrown out and all the stuff that we tended to do only to the empire. It's now coming home to roost. Dividend stripping of any local body, a church, a charity, a women's institute, anything that's got organisation and a bit of local money is finding itself dividend stripped. What does that involve? That involves the centre of the body, often controlled by the City of London, being told, pay your dues. Every local club, every local congregation of a church is told, you are liable for the liabilities you own, mostly your building in the case of a church or a society. You won't get any money from the centre to rescue it, to fix your infrastructure. You still have your maintenance of your liability, but it's an asset to us. You keep paying your dues to us. We get ready cash in every year. Okay, that's how the country's being bled dry. You also have this triad. I'm very grateful to our defence correspondent, David Ellis, for talking to me about this. The elites see a triangle that needs to be optimised, the three sides of which, or the points, if you like, probably the sides, are currency, energy, and population, particularly working-age population. Okay? The cull Brian is talking about is a livestock approach to the population. We only want working-age population. Why do we want millions of strong, able-bodied third-world men? Because they're away from home, they're going to buy domestic basics, whether they're living in shelters or centres or wherever, they're all going to want bedding and lamps and all the usual stuff that we're not buying anymore because we're ageing or whatever, or we have it all. That's going to keep the corporations ticking over. And when you're at that level of operation, you see a working age person as a positive flow of currency and even of energy. And you see the elderly and the disabled and all the people whom the Nazis got rid of under their T4 program and everything else, which is a British idea ultimately, eugenics, you see them as a threat to the model. They're a drain on resources. So they call that optimization. This is where the population numbers control is coming in. There's also a core technique of blackmail. Brian has already gone into that. We don't need to say much more about this. And a lot of bluster. You know, you've got these bent lawyers, bent accountants, bent receivers, bent liquidators plaguing Britain now, seeding themselves outwards from the city into the local business world now. And when a company is forced to go bust through nefarious means, through the banks and lending policy and whatnot, businesses and homes will deliberately be sold for a fraction of their true worth to enrich others. Okay, so that's bluster of a cabal. You know, you have to sell to us, and a bent judge in some cases will allow this to happen. Regulatory capture, jumping into bed with government and with regulatory bodies. A classic example would be the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency and its equivalents in other countries, like OCALESP in France. Psychographics, plotting the mind of the population, seeing what they're thinking, seeing what the cabals can get away with, right up to genocide. Hype is a core technique. Inflate the value of worthless book assets. Gordon Bowden talks about this a lot in his Pandora's Box investigations, that mines are bought known to be empty shells, what they call a care and maintenance mine. There's nothing there but tailings, and there's a security liability. You have to patrol the site. They're bought, and before you know it, they've been sold onwards, including by the French state-owned nuclear fuels body, Areva, a few years ago, in one case, a uranium mine, sold for, you know, half a trillion. A matter of months later, just as sheer profiteering. That allows money laundering. And then, as I said, and this is also something I'm indebted to Gordon Bowden for, boiler rooms and shell companies, they allow the shuffling around of stripped assets. So far, so general. These are all the doom and gloom techniques we see. Now I want to focus in on two wings and see why this is. I will, I think, skip that slide. Those are core techniques. I'll just go through them. Fiat currency, administrative law, party whipping, cabal control of healthcare and education, compounding, as in interest and lending, royal prerogative, double-hattedness, you know, I am the minister for so-and-so and I'm also a member of a secret society, and fiduciary duty being denied. I don't follow my orders from my constituents, I follow my conscience as an MP, which, you know, some MPs are so blunt now, they actually say, before I was elected, I told you that I was going to do this, but now I'm my own master, bog off, you know? Right, so which cabals run Britain? Now we get into the pairings. Sorry for that galloping introduction, but that's an overview of what cabals are first. Now, step back, what's their philosophies? The dominant cabal, after a few years of looking at this, I think, running Britain, is best called Aristotelian. It takes its ideas from the philosopher Aristotle. In a classic British education, if any of you went to grammar school or public school or whatever, you may have been told that Aristotle was the liberty-loving figure in Greek philosophy because he talked about individual conscience, natural law, minimal government. The Anglo-Saxon way of life almost develops out of Aristotelian thinking. You know, people are wicked, governments will get wicked if they get too much power, absolute power corrupts absolutely. We were told that Aristotle was the first liberal in a non-party political sense, and that he was the master of free trade and spreading nice ideas around the world. Well, all it really is about opening up the world and people's minds to any kind of influence, and you'll see more about that in a moment. Who is of the core Aristotelian type of elitism in Britain? I think without a doubt the current Germano-Dutch royal family we have and their continental royal family equivalents, particularly the Dutch royal family, with whom they form a cabal called the Club of the Isles, as in Anglo-Dutch Shell and Unilever and so on, joint companies on both sides of the North Sea. The Church of England for sure. Secular Zionism, not religious Zionism, secular Zionism I think is in the Aristotelian mould, and the communist interests that survived the conflagration of the Second World War. Particularly the Trotskyites who infest the BBC, the global revolutionary strand who don't give a toffee about their own country or any other country, they just want to seed out the ideas and see the world collapse in revolution to form a new world order. But you have a secondary cabal, and it's never been very strong in Britain, but nowadays it is coming to the fore, particularly through its US growing strength. And this is a Eurasia-based kind of elitism called, well, I call it Platonism, because it looks to another Greek philosopher of the golden age of philosophy, Plato. And of course, he's closely associated with Socrates in thinking. Socrates is like the honest Platonist. He's saying there are boundaries to what I can know, but I know that there's more out there, and I'm just learning to know more. Platonism and Neoplatonism especially twists that again, much like the Aristotelians are far more negative than Aristotle himself. They're no longer genuine inquirers. As time goes on, Platonism is about teaching some people, okay, this line is from Plato himself, so he was this bad, teaching people for the sake of peace in the state that some are born with gold in their souls. Do you recognize this quote from Plato? Some are born with silver and some with bronze. In other words, the oldest Huxley, Brave New World, you're born an alpha, beta, gamma, delta, or epsilon. You accept your role, okay? You learn to love it with sexualization and drugs helping you along the way. And this really gives rise to a technocratic or scientist, you know, scientism as in the religion of science, science as a religion, a scientist establishment which has never been really strong in Britain until the Second World War. Some parts of the Roman Catholic Church, the parts which are more Roman than Christian, shall we say, the ones that go back to the old patrician, ancient Roman Empire families, the type who David Ellis in his recent talk on EU military unification said are looking to recreate the Roman Empire through military unification and taxation union. Those parts are believe in Platonism, and some of the Nazi continuation interests, but not all. Nazism is very complex, and this is why people fall out about it so much, because it starts off largely Aristotelian and ends up mostly Platonist. Okay, so when you're talking about Nazi continuation interests, be very clear to yourself first what kind they are. Those who were at AV9 will remember this slide. Brian just mentioned the Bank for International Settlements. And here, in actually the History Documentary Channel's graphic, quite a good one, it shows the pre-war flow of money from Britain, France, Benelux, and indeed above all the United States, mostly New York bankers, through neutral Switzerland, where the BIS is headquartered, into Nazi Germany. After the war, the money went out again. So I call it a reverse Dad's Army, because most people are familiar with the arrows of Hitler going to the Channel and threatening Britain. The real assault was we put our dirty money into Germany before the war. During the war, Nazi Germany, and particularly places like Auschwitz, were used for research in refining the cabal models. And then that knowledge was exfiltrated back to the United States, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union after the war. I also mentioned that when Britain, France, and America act together, it is in this tripartite alliance. Well, these now would say, for the purposes of this talk, are the sharp end of Aristotelianism. Okay, these mystical medieval orders, the Order of the Star in the case of France, the Order of the Garter in Britain, and the Society of the Cincinnati in America, look back to ancient Rome and seek to govern in the Aristotelian model. Now I'm going to have to give more details about what these philosophies actually are. Good. Plato. Anyone heard of Plato's cave? Right. There you see it illustrated in a classic 17th century model, okay? The Antrum Platonicum, Plato's cave. There's the plebs. There's the enlightened souls, the philosopher kings. And there is glorious knowledge. What's happening is the plebs are living in darkness. They're watching a shadow play. They're watching one of these puppet shows where you're just using your hands and creating shadows on the screen. And the plebs, basically, in the Platonist belief, are being told by these ignorant priests and philosophers, look, here is the shape of what the world looks like, but it's really only a shadow. If you're a real Platonist and want to help the world in that kind of elitism, what you do is say, come out of your religions, come out of your body. The body is a tomb. In Greek, it sounds nicer, soma, sema. The body is a tomb. Become pure mind and spirit. Liberate yourself from your corporeality. Lose your physicality, become transhumanist, plug your mind into the cloud, live forever, okay? Truth and spirituality are out there, okay? Aristotle's liberalism degenerates the other way. This is the front cover of a very famous work of political philosophy. Possibly someone might recognize that. Do you know what book that is? Very good. Thomas Hobbes's book from the period of the English Civil War, when these ideas were really starting to wrestle in Britain for supremacy in our elite. This is Thomas Hobbes's book, Leviathan, and he really is political philosophy of Aristotelianism in a nutshell. You might know the famous quotation that without government, says Thomas Hobbes, people's life would be solitary, brutish, poor, nasty, and short. Right? Man is a jungle creature. Leviathan, why is Leviathan this massive figure, King Charles in this case, with, can you see what he's got? He's got the sword of state, the monopoly of violence and policing in the army on one hand. And what's he got in the other? Yes, a bishop's crozier. Because in the middle of the book, Thomas Hobbes says, the plebs will believe whatever the priests tell them, so we better control the priest training at university very well. Okay? So that's a very different model. It's not shake off the shackles of religion and become pure enlightened spirit. Aristotelianism is basically, you haven't really got a spirit. You're just a brain. You know, it's all neurological phenomena. Be happy with your body. Give us your mind, and we'll control your body for you, and that will make you happy. Okay? Platonists are interested in your mind only. Aristotelians are interested in your body only. You can see, I think, already how both of these agendas, as Brian described, are at the sharp end of what we're seeing. Aristotle's liberalism, this is a quote from Aristotle himself, says that when perfected, which means brutalized and kept in order by government and told a pack of lies about how limited he is, then man is the best of animals. What are animals? They're bodies that appear to have spirits, but really they only act on command by stimulus and by neurological control. That's what we are in the Aristotelian scheme. We don't really have a spirit. But, says Aristotle, when separated from law and justice, that's from the rule of cabals, not common law, he is the worst of animals. I'll leave this up for a moment for you to peruse. These are some of the dichotomies between the two cabals that I think I have worked out over the last few years. Aristotelianism, which is the one we are most familiar with if we grew up in Britain or in some of the other countries I'm going to show on a subsequent slide where it predominates, basically the sea power countries. Aristotelianism believes in abolishing the nation state. It's globalist. It believes in meritocracy, which means spot someone regardless of his affiliations and his real loyalties and say, work for us, give us your brain. It's Anglo-Saxon liberalism. If you know Gilad Atzmon's work, then it's Jerusalem. It's this is above contradiction and that kind of bogus conservatism. This has been established, don't challenge it. It believes in interventionism and the responsibility to protect. That's the pretext for invading other countries and also invading our own underclass now and stealing as many children as we can get away with because the parents are not fit to bring up the children. So that's all in the spirit of interventionism. It believes in what's lyingly called free trade, which is actually, of course, corporatism, because you elbow the smaller players and the foreigners out of the market. It believes in, shall we say, attracting a followership through religion. And there's two ways to do that, depending on the time and the mood and the people you're dealing with. You either ham up a religion and have a sacerdotal caste, a priestcraft that says, believe in this. You know, you until a certain point in British history, you could do this through Anglicans, or before them, Roman Catholics. Roman Catholic Church centrally also believes in some of this, although they straddle the divide. Or if people are no longer prepared to accept the churches, not least because they see all the abuse that goes on in them, then you can flip and do a Dawkins and preach atheism as a religion, as a fervent, zealous, evangelical belief system. That is equally good because that's equally energy-consuming and creates the same kind of prejudices and narrow-mindedness as religious fundamentalism does. Aristotelianism says we should accept our limitations. We're all flawed. We shouldn't have too much government, i.e. the people shouldn't have too much control over what their governments do in their name. Yeah? And an aversion to progress. This is where the stealing of the intellectual property comes in, why the crown has been busy through crown agents and so on, and the corporations attached to the crown, nicking everyone's good ideas and having secret agreements that the crown can either put them in a vault or use them for its own purposes. It's because if people progress, they're not going to accept that the rule of their betters over them, whether it's priests or technocrats or whatever. Also politicized, I stress politicized green ideology. Because the Bush, Clinton, Obama cabal is now coming into Europe and using the Greens. The Clintons in particular are, you might be following continental politics, they're fiddling the ballot boxes now to get the modern, not the 1970s original ambitious Greenism, but the modern Greenism, the anti-human idea of, you know, we are producing too much CO2, we all need to die. That Greenism, which is, you know, very much, as you look at how the people talk and act, who run this modern Greenism, you know, some of them are in those posts because the first generation of Greens were assassinated either physically or in character. Okay? So Germany in particular, you see the Greens doing this now. The Clintons came in during Oktoberfest this year and actually oversaw, I think, the ballot stuffing in Germany and indeed Italy to get this massive swing to the Greens, because that's the chosen vessel. You see how it ties in with Aristotelianism? Because we're all beasts, right? We should all be earthy and physical, and we should, you know, we act as if our bodies are the only things that matter. Okay, so that's the chosen ideology. You might think this is a bit strange for the British elite to do this, but to give just one example, do you remember Jimmy Goldsmith, Referendum Party, absolute Aristotelianism apparently, because he's talking about, you know, free Britain, get out of the EU. He was the first to advocate a referendum. You can connect him right through to Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. How? Their respective brothers were best chums. Edward Goldsmith was a key eugenicist in the mold of Thomas Malthus, and his best mate was Julian Huxley, the biological based eugenicist. Okay, so you've got the Anglo-Saxon elites actually running something as German, as foreign as this idea of green ideology, and shaping it. Now then, Platonism. This has always been the enemy of Britain's elite. So you have a predisposition, if you're born in Britain and brought up in its education system, not to like these guys, although in some ways, they're less detrimental to humanity. Platonism believes that people work best in nation states, that they should be persuaded to work in nation states. It's quite happy to use populism, growth of populism these days. Steve Bannon is a key example, a Roman Catholic of the old blue-blooded European model in America, and he's now working together with some of the cardinals in the Roman Catholic Church to create a populist front, which is likely to sweep Europe in next spring's European Parliament elections to give a fake sense of opposition to what's going on under the model of nationalism, keep the borders closed. It's the Prussian model. It's the obligatory education, shaping people to be of use to their country, which was quite dominant in America in the past. It's called American nationalism or the American system, and it was dominant under Abraham Lincoln, for example. Senator Henry Clay was the evangelist who persuaded Lincoln of that. It's, rather than Jerusalem, it's Athens. It promotes the idea of free exchange of opinions. After all, it believes that we ought to aim to be pure spirit and be freed from the tombs of our bodies. So it believes, apparently, in socialism, discussion, democracy. But actually, it's pure intellectual onanism in the end. We don't actually do anything in the world with our ideas. So it's a fake kind of Athens. According to its detractors in the history textbooks, it's often called isolationist, because when America was doing well under this model, particularly in the first half of the 20th century, staying out of wars as long as they could manage to keep the bankers at bay, the Americans were called by their detractors, the Aristotelian Anglo-Saxon model, they were being called isolationists because they believed every country should work on its own productivity and that its contribution to the world should not be coming to ride to the rescue in wars, but to give them ideas and products that would help better their lives and focus them on peaceful ends. Platonism also believes in tariffs. You're beginning to see that Donald Trump and Steve Bannon in particular, his former advisor, is of this model. It believes, which the Aristotelians call barriers to trade. They don't like it. But it allows domestic industry and domestic infrastructure to get to a high level without being exploited from outside, such as by City of London corporations. It believes in philosophy over religion. You can be an Anglican, a Methodist, a Muslim, whatever you like, but what takes precedence is your allegiance to the nation state and its rather totalitarian government in this model. It believes that mankind can be perfected, not told that it's limited and will always be stupid and poor and get used to having broken bodies, that kind of NHS approach. No, it believes that mankind can be ennobled through its own greatness to discovering the God within. It believes in a politicized form of scientism, and at the elite level, it believes in the hermetic belief, as above, so below. We're trying to recreate on Earth what we Platonist elitists think the heavens are like, the harmony of the spheres that Plato went on about. If only we could have a perfect copy. It's a godless vision. If we could have a perfect copy of the physical, mechanical nature of the universe on Earth, then the good vibes would go out throughout the world. You know, some of the advocates of this actually talk about forcing people to listen to classical music because the good vibes will actually make them harmonious, so that it's a lot less innocuous than it seems, actually, this scheme. And without getting into very esoteric elements, I'll just mention the idea of a cosmic war features very strongly in Platonism, and it was the dominant idea of the ancient Greeks and of the Germans in their early Nazi period. This idea that actually that our heroic Aryan forefathers threw off the rule of the gods and became as gods to themselves on Earth, basically directly took on the role of ruling as gods. So rather than the Aristotelian model of let's cooperate under the rule of God, God, who's actually Satan, and God has just said that the world will be like this and you have to get used to sexual abuse and limitation and violence and whatnot, it's the way of the world. The Platonists say, no, let's cast off these old gods, the rule of the Titans, and bring in our own rule, be gods to ourselves. This is a very popular idea among the elites of Germany and Russia during the 20th century. And actually, at some times, even when their armies are destroying each other, the German and Russian elites are talking to each other and saying, come on, let's actually get together and we can throw off the whole Anglo-Saxon model and be a Eurasian superpower based on the productivity of Russian resources and German brains. What's the gliding philosophies behind all this mass? Aristotelianism basically believes in mercantilism. Some of you, I know Ian's mentioned this book in the past, will be familiar with Carol Quigley. That's Carol with two R's and two L's. It's a man's name. Carol Quigley was Bill Clinton's history tutor at Georgetown University, a prime center of Aristotelianism in the world, really, interventionism and so on. Mercantilism, if you read the opening pages of Quigley's Tragedy and Hope, that turgid 1,000-page book about why the Aristotelians must rule the world, in the opening chapters, you're thinking, what's all this detail about the stages of capitalism? He's going on about how the mercantilists made their money in the Middle Ages, in the early modern period. What's behind that all is he's saying, look, a bunch of us chaps have got the market sewn up, and as soon as too many ideas or too many good people flow into our closed system, we're being wrecked. So we have to either get rid of these guys, eject them, make them stupid and poor and broken again, or expand by forcing another territory into another territory and taking it over. So this is why Quigley talks about the mercantilists always trying to push the borders, and eventually their bubble bursts, you know, in some cases literally like the South Sea bubble or the stock market crashes of the 20th century, another one coming soon. And then they have to look for another bigger model or weed out the competition within the existing domain that they have. Richard Branson, at a sort of super fest of the Aristotelians in the Vatican City in 2016 with the Pope smiling beneficently on all these moneymakers of the Anglo-Saxon mold, Branson enumerated this. A Dutch lady I'm in contact with lightly edited his comments for clarity and came up with this. Branson said, the people don't trust us corporates, and governments are incapable of robust decision-making because democracy cramps their style. Do you remember Justin Trudeau talking about admiring the People's Republic of China? And we know, I wish we could get things done in Canada like by decree like that. This is all the Aristotelian thinking coming out because the Aristotelians created communism, right? As a testbed for their ideas. Branson went on to say, populism, that's Platonism, okay, is also a danger to us merchants of the earth. So the Pope was saying at this meeting, my mercantilist children, help us to keep this model running. Platonism has an emphasis on infrastructure and productivity. Jack Ma, a Chinese tycoon, the Chinese are inherently very Platonist, says when trade stops, war starts. I think the Aristotelians look through the other end of the telescope and say, let's start a war so we can have trade. The Platonists say, no. Let's be peace-loving, apparently, and beneficial to mankind by saying we won't have war as long as there's lots and lots of trade of ideas and ideas coming on. JFK was perhaps the last Platonist or American nationalist US president, and that's probably why he met his demise. And of course, he famously said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Even that turns sinister if you see it in the lens of elitism. You know, you lot are going to be happily employed knocking out infrastructure, increasing our GDP, and feeling that the state's there for you, so, you know, Mussolini-type state, nothing outside the state, Mussolini says. That's, if you look at it through an elitist point of view, we own you, just as much as we do in the Aristotelian model. What is specific to each of these two cabals? Aristotelianism, to my mind and in my research, is the only one of the two that uses child abuse and Satanism. I think wherever the Platonists get in the ascendancy, they try to decry this and bring it out into the open, and with some degree of reticency about QAnon and XAnon and the like, it's a very complicated field. I think that what Donald Trump's better advisors of the more pro-humanity side of Platonism are saying to him is, look, you can overturn these Aristotelians by exposing their use of child abuse. There's many reasons why Aristotelians like child abuse. In, you know, bound up with their own view of the world, that it's all about sucking energy out of people and keeping them in a cowed state of terror and keeping them broken and so on. Black magic in various forms, including physical forms like how cities are designed, how buildings are laid out and so on, which often, and I have good sources to back me up on this, that, often where you see neurolinguistic programming being taught to teach us, not for helping individuals as a therapy, but, you know, come and learn NLP so that you can actually make lots of money as a trainer of it yourself, that kind of marketing approach to NLP. Many cases, people who practice this at a high level will admit, yes, I'm a black magician, and NLP is a good front, it's a good plaque to have on my door. Among the Aristotelians, fiat currency, creating money out of nothing, beggaring nations by doing so, is actually preached as a virtue. Right, so we had Andy Haldane of the Bank of England talking a couple of years ago, unprecedentedly, about yes, we create all these, you know, loads of zeros out of thin air, and it's good because it keeps the plebs ticking over. Right, it ridicules the little people. It says nature's on our side. You can't work against us, Aristotelians, because you'll be fighting against nature itself if you try. You're destined to these limitations. Aristotelianism believes in expanding on Earth, as I mentioned a moment ago, in stitched-up markets. Okay. It doesn't actually want to progress, it wants to contain. It appeals to tradition, including religious ideas, and, to use David Hawkins' ideas, it excels in man-in-the-middle approaches. You're in the infrastructure, you're assassinating people or squashing ideas or flattening whistleblowers by being inside the structures themselves, including by stealing intellectual property. Platonism seems more positive, but it can be just as negative. Platonists' approaches are, they like setting up cults and they like mind control more. As you know, it's a Germanic idea, generally, mind control. And it comes through various channels from Central Europe, both Jewish and Gentile, until Britain. It embeds itself after the Second World War in the LSE and the Tavistock Institute, having been originally a Central European idea, a Platonist idea. All these activists, it's much more American than our thing, but if you meet all these activists trying to promote you to an aggressive new ideology on the street in a cultish way, and these aren't just religious cults there, it can be economic cults or business or self-help cults. Anything based on getting a mental vibe among people, positive or trying to get energies flowing, is more redolent of Platonism. Ideas of championing the workers, that kind of so-called socialism, although it's not really of the people, because you get appointed representatives of the workers stitching backroom deals with the bosses. The idea of sound money, a false opposition to fiat currency, you know, going into Bitcoin, for example, or certain kinds of supposedly precious metal-backed monies that can't be verified. It's a different approach in that regard as well. Platonism, because it's populist, it ridicules the elite, not the little people. Platonism's particular carrot or bait dangle in front of people is not nature is against you if you leave our model. There's nothing out there but a howling wilderness. Platonism says, stay with us, stay on board with us, and there's more to discover. We can open up space. We can go mining the asteroids, all this kind of idea. Hence, Trump's Space Force and the Star Wars initiatives of the 1980s and so on. It's one of the reasons why satellites are such hot property right now. It's not just about eye in the sky. It's also about expanding into space. In a statist corporatist model, as I say, there is a positive form of this idea as well, but I'm talking about the elitist form. Platonism doesn't appeal to tradition. It says throw away all the old traditions. You know, who cares if a few million people get butchered along the route? But we're going to progress into a new world, a brave new world. And Platonism's approach to intellectual property is not squirrel it away, steal it and bury it, but abolish it. So, for example, Israel, Russia, China, as they go more Platonist through the 20th century, they believe in stealing America's and Britain's technology and replicating it without compensation. Where are the geographical strongholds? Starting at the bottom, then, the Aristotelian model likes to hang around the edge of continents and on islands just off the continents. It seeks out these domains, starting with Venice, or actually starting with Tyre and Carthage, islands off the Eurasian landmass. And so it nestles in our part of the world, both the Anglo-Saxon nations, the white English-speaking nations, and also the Commonwealth, which is why the Commonwealth is being pushed so much now, as this globalist anti-nation state idea, a family of diversity, etc. The old families in France, the Frankish families, are Aristotelian. Benelux, very much in the continent, but not of it, because they believe in Aristotelian elitism. Israel, in terms of its founding fathers, not the mass of Israelis today, but certainly the labor founders of Israel, the kibbutz types, and then later the Likudniks, the more reactionary ones, they also believe in Aristotelian models to control the world. And Japan, which was co-opted from 1904 onwards, really, first to bash Russia and then to bash China, so that the Aristotelians could keep dominance over Eurasia. And then with the Islamic world, the fundamentalist and pseudo-fundamentalist streams of Sunnism which have come out recently, which have cooperated gladly with the Third Reich, for example, or with the British, and have been used as convenient patsies in those, they have been in the Aristotelian mould. There's an emphasis on sea power, and if you are a real Aristotelian elitist, like a Trotsky, for example, or a Lenin, you're perfectly prepared, or a Stalin, you're perfectly prepared to see the Germans, egged on by the British often, to invade your country and kill 40 million of your people, or Mao is another example. He did it himself, he didn't need a foreign power. Because who cares? A new world is coming, and then besides, they're only cattle anyway. They ought to die as cattle. Okay. So if you see the kind of treason that will say, flog off the NHS and I don't care how many old people die, that's more Aristotelian persuasion, inviting disaster. Platonism's model says, where is it strongest? It believes in building up and taking a cautious approach and having cash in the bank and giving everyone a taste of the money. So the German old money, which is about to flip out of Allied control back into a Russo-Chinese model, believes in that. Russia and China do, but not their economics, not their central planners. They have been schooled in the West. And that's the Achilles heel of Russia and China right now, is that the military is right on side with this Platonist positive development infrastructure-based model, but not the bankers in those countries and not the economic ministries. The United States, for its first two centuries, was of this Platonist mold. As if, in the more you consider American history through this prism, I think you'll be able to see that. And that disappeared in the post-Second World War generation. We then take over, or the Aristotelians take over. Italy, but not the northern Italian banking families, they're Aristotelian. Italy's Roman nobility, the patricians that go right back to the fall of Rome, they had esoteric knowledge. They believe belong in that. Shi'ism in the Islamic world, particularly Iran, is of this model, a natural ally of Russians and Chinese, because it's talking about increasing popular wealth, increasing people's stake in the country, trading outside the country without borders. It emphasizes land power and it seeks long-term stability, although in the end it wants to dominate just as much. Here's some examples of how the century got going. After the First World War, which I talked a little bit about in AV9, what was the effect of the First World War if you look at it from the warring elites? Well, you've dismantled six empires in order to create one new one, arguably. The three Eastern empires that were destroyed out of the First World War had imperial families that were still autocratic, and they were just shot to pieces. Okay? Because to varying degrees, I think the Romanovs in Russia mostly, they believed in Platonism, they believed in having national wealth, sharing the resources well, giving people a hand up, although Russia was extremely poor and backwards, yes. That's why it was chosen for a communist experiment. But these families were ritually murdered in many cases by agents of the British Crown, which goes on through history. It happened under Edward VII with the Portuguese family over Angolan concessions. It happens to the Nepalese royal family not many years ago. There's been five times the British royal family's agents have assassinated an entire royal family in another country. And one of these was the Romanovs in Russia. So these imperial families in the East were deposed because they're the Eurasians. That's where the real threat is, the Platonists. They've got to be squashed if you're an Aristotelian. The Western empires, the British, the French, and the Italian, which were the great powers before the war in the West, they were, you know, okay, the two of the three were monarchies, but they were already sort of republican in form. And so that wasn't to the Aristotelians' liking. It wasn't elitist enough. We'd had too much democratization in the 19th century in the West. So we had to bleed these empires dry. The prizes of the First World War, and you probably know this is how Russia was dragged in, is that they were promised Constantinople and Smyrna, these great power centers and nodes that Russia is still very concerned about, the Bosphorus, the Crimea, and so on. You can see them coming together at this point. The Kellogg-Briand Pact is the French and British foreign ministries saying, let's make war impossible by building a supranational state. Quite obscure things between the wars, like the Achnacarry Agreement of 1928, which brings the German old money, who are inherently Platonist and Prussian, they're not of our elitist model, they're of the other kind, bringing them in and giving them a piece of the action. Imperial Chemical Industries, ICI, made a cartel with Solvay, the Belgian chemical giant of the time. So you've got a cabal, you know, for the first time in history, really, during the 20th century, you've got Platonist and Aristotelian saying, this world ain't big enough for the both of us. We're going to have to merge our operations, which gives you a hint that there's someone above the two levels, which I'll come back to at the end. The League of Nations is formed, the world's first supranational body. And Lord Milner had spoken at the beginning of the 20th century, 1903, about the aristocrats' burden. And the aristocrats wanted to shed that burden and let the technocrats run the world. And the aristocrats themselves, they only have to meet once a year at Bilderberg and similar groups and say, all right, you're it for next year. See if you can achieve our aims. So that is the transference. The aristocrats are now free to play, which is why they degenerate completely into child sexual abuse and other forms of decrepitude and depravity during the century. They've got no work to do anymore. Punitive reparations of Germany. Okay, this is only makes sense if you look at it in the form of the Aristotelians trying to squash the Platonists, the rising threat of Germany. Okay, it didn't work to beat them in war. They're still trying to rebuild, so we're going to put punitive reparations on them. And some of the people in this model actually want to create a single cabal out of this model by having another world war. They can see the Second World War coming. They're egging it along so that afterwards they can set up the UN and have a more tightly controlled allied control of Germany, for example. So Dulles and Clemenceau are good examples of that. Ultimately, it's the completion of the mercantilist takeover. The Aristotelians are now running as the dominant arm, a single world cabal, and the oligarchic century can begin, undoing in many ways much of the 19th century, in which knowledge and democracy spread a great deal. I talked about Nazi agendas before. All of these are Aristotelian in the Third Reich, okay? So in a fundamentally Platonist country, we, our elite, sowed the seeds of these ideas. Ahnen Erbe, the idea of a mystical inheritance from the ancestors, the Thule Gesellschaft, that we, the northern folk, will rule the world, be a Herrenvolk, a race of gentlemen, the first ever green, pseudo-green legislation, the Reichsnaturschutz, the imperial, or the Reich protection of nature law, comes in under Herr Göring, who is one of the blue bloods in the Nazi framework. Most of them were low-born thugs, the Nazi leaders. Not Göring and Hess. They were gentlemen who spoke fluent English, who were well used to dealing with English businessmen, and they were secretly Aristotelian, you see. So Göring puts this on the Reich and says Germany's going to lead the world in fake green politics. And the real reason for this protecting the Reich nature is communal use goes before property rights, Gemeinnutz vor Eigennutz. Okay? So this is an example of how you can actually undo public ownership, which has happened to Britain in our day. The British strategist Sir Halford Mackinder influences Karl Haushofer and Rudolf Hess, who have Hitler's ear geopolitically. So Hitler's geopolitics, his idea of seizing Ukraine as the heartland of the world island, is actually a British Aristotelian sea power idea. There's been suggestions that even Ernst Röhm of the Sturmabteilung, the Brown Shirts, was a French agent. Certainly something that David Irving has got good arguments for. At the end of the war, Martin Bormann, who was probably the most Aristotelian of all the Nazis, so the most traitorous to Germany as a country, the kind of the equivalent of Lenin, who said, sod Russia, I don't care if they all die as long as we get our communist revolution to export. Bormann's the same in the Third Reich. He's basically at the end saying, sod Germany. He's got many interests in Ukraine, as Bormann. He's probably not really got German interests at heart ever. At the end of the war, we exfiltrate Bormann. The best book to read on that is Op JB. I think that's more than a theory. We certainly did. His signature is on checks well after the war, because he was the chap during the war who signed the checks for Hitler's salary and anyone employed by the Nazi party. You get this idea of a brotherhood of death, right? So this is, again, very Aristotelian. A bunch of mostly Freemasons is how it's organized, but this is Eisenhower and Truman are in on this, Churchill and Stalin, the idea that nuclear secrets and nuclear technology is going to be the new way to threaten to reduce the population, to cow them into terrified submission. The very thought of nuclear war will make them abjectly submissive, and maybe we can use the nuclear war at some point to thin the population and get rid of all these pesky new ideas and technology which are threatening our Aristotelian rule over the population of sheep. All of this has been written about in a book which is not yet in English, by one of the three holders of Russia's nuclear football during the early Putin era, Leonid Ivashov, who was chief of general staff of the Russian Federation just after 2000, may appear in English translation one day. I'll see if I can do it myself. But he's talking about how the Aristotelian, he doesn't use the word Aristotelian, but how that thinking took over Germany and subverted the Third Reich, really. I think we have only about 15 minutes left or less. Is that right, Ian? 10 minutes, right. So I will skip some of these. Oh, we're quite near the end. Just to see how many. Yes, we've got. Yeah, we can just about do this. This is a particular example. I had to keep it very general because there's a big picture of what's behind the scenes, and I hope you go away and think about this more and reapply this prism to your existing stock of knowledge of what's going on, that there isn't just a single elitist persuasion at play, that there's actually geopolitical and familial-based oppositions going on within this. But here's an example, I think, of how asset stripping is done, which explains, you can replicate this in how any aspects of post-war Britain is being undermined, whether it's NHS, whether it's common law policing, whether it's proper schooling. I think this is a generalized version of a case known to me of how a local Church of England congregation was stripped of its assets, which is going on up and down the country, particularly in the CEV, but in any church as well. The key insight of these shysters is that if you aggregate the little people's money power, it's huge. Even if you have a state corporatist model, the huge corporations cannot, by definition, own more of the nation's wealth than all the little people put together. So you aggregate to accumulate. The key technique they use is you exert a pseudo-legal right to administer the little people's assets. A church congregation, any society, a club, a discussion group, whatever you like, a family, owns certain assets, particularly physical assets like its building, but also its intellectual goods. It's in being because the group of physical people at that location have got together and are of like mind or of shared blood. You introduce a central layer, which is there initially just to do the admin, to take the membership dues and send out the secretarial stuff, and eventually that starts sucking in. Pay your dues above all else, even if you're ruining yourselves. The building and your local stuff, that's all your liability, but to us, you're an asset. So in the case of the C of E, you dwindle the congregations and bring in deliberately more managerial bishops. You impose a responsibility to be self-funding, but you then hedge about those responsibilities so that people can't, whether they're a congregation or whatever secular equivalent, they can't administer themselves, even as they're being told to. You assert that the centre controls the assets, but that the liabilities are local. It's pure City of London, this. Being done with the National Estate, the MOD estate was the trial run, now it's being done with the whole portfolio of government, which is our stuff. You keep the congregations light in accounting terms. You don't allow them to carry money over. So they can't carry sufficient reserves to have a buffer in case the organ goes bust or the tower falls down. You suck any local funds that aren't ring-fenced. English trust law is your guide here. This, you know, it's your saviour at common law, is that, that money is held in trust even if the word trust isn't used. If it comes before a proper English court, that will be found to be the case. But if it's not ring-fenced, it can be sucked into the centre using quota payments. You register each of the regional apparatuses, in the case of the C of E, this would be the diocesan structures, as a separate charity so that the central staff, the bishop and his sidekicks, are all being paid out of a separate ring-fenced charity with its own charity number and its own assets. The result is that you have separately funded private clubs, the dioceses or whatever, local bodies of any kind, wielding public clout and speaking in the name of the Church of England, when in fact they're not a private club. It's this corporatization of public assets again. You start a drive. Everyone up your quotas. And you have chums on hand to milk this extra money which is donated. Now, what you've brought about is congregations or any other body that's equivalent can no longer exist independently. And if it's complained about, you just claim that you're a caring profession and you have a duty to oversee these things. What you've done is you've fleeced the flock, you've shorn them, you've broken your trust or duty. You make sure that the hiring and firing is done centrally, so that now the centre has a hold over who the key guy is locally. Nobody looks at the adjusted accounts or checks the balances. This is the scam. You know, people who are in any kind of public or local society need to be checking that the accounts have been properly adjusted. Don't just take it on a say-so at an annual meeting. The centre now holds the capital asset, the building or whatever, and the intellectual property or the idea, and the funds, the release of funds for capital spending is now done only on the centre's terms. So who's in the centre? We've got no idea. They won't release names to us in many of these cases now. Another example, which I can just cover in 2 minutes, is EU military unification. The key interest here is the intellectual property, that the goods, or the bads, rather, that cause nuclear war and make it possible, is the control of fissile material. A country is a first-rank nuclear power, a first-rank military power if it has nuclear capability. It has nuclear capability if it has delivery systems, and it can only have delivery systems if it's got fissile material to go bang in. We have our stockpile at Aldermaston, the French have theirs in the Alps at Val d'Uc, and the core of the Franco-British merger, Aristotelians writ large really, is there's now going to be a single stockpile of fissile material. Aldermaston and Val d'Uc are basically merged. The know-how is in one and the stockpile's in the other. They can't operate independently. This is why the policing has been hammered so hard, and why, as soon as Mrs. May came into power, Her G4S shareholding husband told her to knock the police and actually to declare war at them at the police union conference by saying, "You lot are useless and I'm going to trample all over you." Why? We need to abolish constabularies because in order to get the single tax base, the centralised asset holding, you need the excuse of military spending. And it's only an excuse because perhaps at the end we'll be taxed a 10% rate for EU military and only 2% of it will be going to the EU military. The rest will be a huge central pot for elite projects. And for, so if that's the case, then you need to abolish the constabularies and bring in a gendarmerie, an armed soldier-like police under global civil law. Hence, the defence industries are being internationalised and even intercontinentalised. There's a North America-Europe union going on of defence structures and manufacturers now. What is the EU military union about? It's more of the marriage of these two, an uneasy coexistence of these two forms of elitism. Core Europe, the Frankish zone, is winding up the franchise it gave to the US military and it's repatriating the function of world police. The Aristotelians or the Anglo-Saxons were only really allowed to be world police because they were useful, likely lads to go around the world. The ownership is actually in the Romano-Franco-German blob and that is now regaining ascendancy in Germany's Fourth Reich, as you say, Brian. So we're preparing for a third world war in which the objective is not to nuke the entire population because then you lose the juicy prize of running the economy in the cities. So the cities will be avoided, it will be battles out at sea, there will be skirmishes, tactical nukes. This is the folly, you know, that both sides, especially the Americans, now think that they can win a limited tactical nuclear war, right? Tactical nukes, laser weapons, rail guns, EMPs, electromagnetic pulses, psychological operations. The idea is to preserve the cities intact so that after the conflagration, the cowed slaves will be ready to be run in a new economy. A very good author on this is David Dionysi, particularly his book Atomic Bomb Secrets. A very Platonist approach to this, but as I say, they're marrying more and more, is this chap. He's even got a German name, so he's a core Prussian thinker, really. William H. Gödel, who at the time was the number two at DARPA, which came out with the internet and lots of other, the wickedness of the internet and many other parts of wickedness. In the 70s, when the Platonists were really having their last gasp in America, he said, "Science as science should no longer be served. Indeed, scientists ought to be made to serve." That's the core philosophy of the US deep state. ukcolumns.org/defence has more and more about this, and please read it through these goggles of the competing Aristotelian and Platonic models and the need to have huge continent-scale spending going on. Why would people long for nuclear war? I've hinted already. Pure sadism or Satanism, depopulation or the threat thereof. It can hide an economic collapse that was going to happen anyway because you drained everything dry. You can escape the blame for economic collapse. You can tip the global climate, either heating or cooling, whatever you want, for the sake of Illuminati, for Illuminism, for sheer profit, because there's a lot of profit in making nuclear war apparatus. You can dominate the rebooted system. That's a good reason to egg on nuclear war if you hide in a bunker or off the planet meanwhile. To have slaves who are mentally enthralled and economically craven. That's something that the Aristotelians and Platonists have in common at top level. You have a fear-driven populace, and some of you are old enough to remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. What everyone who remembers 62 says to me is, you couldn't think of tomorrow. You were lying in bed every night thinking, are we going to wake up in the morning? Very useful, isn't it, to have a population that never thinks beyond today or saves. And you, if you're a real hardcore Satanist, what this does, it heralds the rise of the Antichrist, the son of Apollo, as some of them call him. Apparently he'll come through the Merovingian bloodline. David Ellis, our nuclear or defence correspondent, put this very aptly in a tweet. So the EU sleeper must awaken. Let's consider the impact for Faslen Royal Naval Base, where we learned today they're actually breaking each other's jaws in fistfights on the quayside, because the base is all the eggs in one basket, centralised control. Centralised control. This is a conference about democracy. I'll end on a caveat. Democracy has many names to it and many ideas behind it. If you want to expand your mind, you should read Hans Hermann Hoppe's book, Democracy, the God That Failed. He particularly describes how, in the forms it was given to us in the 20th century, democracy didn't live up to its name, and it ended up being a tyranny. The Greeks knew this. They said that democracy is the last stage before tyranny, in a certain sense of defining democracy. So my conclusions are, the Aristotelians want the lives of the British people to be solitary, brutish, nasty, poor, and short, because that's their worldview anyway. It's an end in itself. That's the quote from Thomas Hobbes, remember? Platonists, who are not really native to our shores, but who are here in increasing numbers, they want the British people brought low so that they can be bought out, so we can be bought out and made to conform, brought to our knees. Yes, the old caricature of the foreign villain rubbing his hands about the downfall of the British. Aristotelians want Britain to stay sort of intact, or at least staggering along on drugs, you know, kind of staying upright, because they want us to seed global revolution, because they think Britain is their mystical mother country. Platonists don't think of Britain as the mother country, they think of it as what the Trotskyites always call the main enemy, the Anglo-American axis. They want to bring Britain down because they have their own plans for a Eurasian empire. Common law, the National Health Service, policing, education, environmental quality, such as is threatened by fracking, these are of no use to either of the two cabals in Britain. And that, I think, is where we're in such a particular quandary, and there's no sense of a national awakening against it, or the sense that we can't do anything against it. Charles Ortel has called this a modern 30 years war against the middle class. I mentioned this slide before, how to counteract. I'll leave it on screen for 2 seconds. That advice hasn't changed since AV9. Exacerbate divisions is particularly important because they are here within our policy structures. I see Ian stood up. More information. David Dionisi, Teach Peace Foundation, with, I think, a $50 donation to his website, teachpeacefoundation.com or .org, I can't remember which. You then obtain access to his electronic library, which is on the other of the two sites, .org or .com. Very warmly recommended view of how this nuclear cabal works. The Russian historian Andrei Fursov has Gobits on YouTube, those two channels particularly, Jabar Badi, Mengu Timur. Joseph P. Farrell is an expert in many books, which you can find free online as PDFs, and he also does talks about Nazi continuation in the West. All these men have got this sense of the duality of Platonism and Aristotelianism. William Engdahl is an expert on the Brotherhood of Death ideas. A website that preserves 1970s material called The Campaigner Unbound has Lyndon LaRouche's material. He's one of the core Platonist writers against the Aristotelians. Dr. Dave Jander has recently done a two-part interview with Sarah Westall, entitled One Unknown Family Rules the World with Two Dueling Branches, and he suggests that some of the Roman families and the French paysers in America are actually above these two cabals. Daniel Estelin, anything he's written about, and particularly his interview, New Movie, exposes Bilderberg, which you'll find on American Free Press. David Hawkins, as I say, definitely him on Jason Goodman now. And next year, if you're fancy a project, you can follow Steve Bannon taking over Europe for Platonism again, using some of the Roman Catholic players, Benjamin Harwell, his Institute for Human Dignity, and Cardinal Burke, who's gone back to Rome to work on that. Final quote. Aneurin Bevin, post-war Labour politician. In Germany, democracy died by the headman's axe. In Britain, it can be by anemia. Thank you very much.
Okay, Alex can always be relied upon to add to my education, but we have no time for questions. No, you have to speak to the speakers. Can we, when we come back after lunch, can we have the Aristotelians on this side and the Platonists on this side? Maybe we have some time for Q&A. We have to see what happens. But otherwise, the forum is to speak with each other and speak with the speakers. I wish we could cram more in, but 9.1, like 8.1, is an interim event. The main event, obviously, is the conference in May. And that's where we create the environment for people to spend 3 days under the same roof and to really have as much conversation and discussion on whatever topic they wish.